Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction. For the next three episodes, I'm being transported back to my GCSE years as we tackle triple science, and we're going to focus in on some biological matter in this first episode. I didn't enjoy science at school, but I just know with these three teachers, I'll be far more focused. So let me introduce the team. First of all, we have the powerhouse of the cell. It's Xenia here to chat about the ancient Romans. Slicing through myths about the ancient Greeks better than CRISPR-Cas9 cuts through DNA, we're also joined by Meg. And from apoptosis to the apotropaic, Barney is here to shed some light on the ancient Near East. I'm Flo, and I'm more non-bio than fairy washing powder, but I'm excited to learn about ancient biology with you, dear listener. So when I put myself in the shoes of someone in the ancient world, it could be quite a scary place to be, I imagine, because you've got lots of things going on. You've got lots of predators, you've got weird diseases, you don't really know what's going on about the whole life cycle. So my thinking is very much that you kind of be trying to make sense of as much as you can with the information that you had, which, you know, without scientific methods, you're not really going to be able to prove anything. So I think a lot of what I imagine the ancient world to be like is based in faith or imagining stories as to why things might be. We've talked a little bit about creation myths, and I wonder if we could talk about sort of the biological basis that people might have based their beliefs on when they were thinking about the origin of life in the ancient world. Does anyone want to hop on that bad boy?
Yeah, so I think when we look at the history of Mesopotamia and the literature that they were putting out, we can see a lot of the work is going some way to kind of explaining the world around the ancients in the way that we might be able to do with science today. And I think we've talked a while ago on maybe one of our superstition episodes or something like that, about how in Mesopotamia there was a sort of logic how they were trying to examine and understand the world, often with omens and divination and stuff like that. But it's just not the sort of logic of the modern scientific method. So it's sort of wrong. It would be wrong to assume that, you know, they're stupid for not understanding how things work. They are sort of trying to explain these things, just not in the same rational, in the modern definition, way that we are today. So I thought what would be an interesting way of looking at like biology and the natural world in Mesopotamia is to look at sort of etiological myths. An etiological myth being a way to explain the natural world. We talked previously about the snake in the Epic of Gilgamesh that makes off with the plant of rejuvenation, and that is offered up as an explanation as to why snakes shed their skin. So that's an etiological myth there. But yeah, so I had a little look through literature to see if I could find any other good examples that sort of explain the world around the Mesopotamians. And there's a good myth called Enki and the World Order, which is concerned with how the sort of the world of the Sumerians, you know, this very early urban civilization came to be. And in this myth, Enki, who's a sort of water god, and the god of craft and knowledge and stuff like that, is tasked by Enlil, who's the chief deity of the Sumerians, to bring this world order into life. And one of the things that the Sumerians are obviously very keen to explain is the origin of the water all around them, because Mesopotamia, land between two rivers, you know, these rivers and the canals that are dug from them are very, very important and fundamental to life there. And in this myth, Enki, the water god, he ejaculates the Tigris River into existence.
Oof.
Yep.
That's quite powerful.
It is potent, you might say.
Yes, one might. Fertile, I might add.
The fertile crescent, yeah, gives a whole new meaning.
It does.
But, you know, it's literal in that sense. And I think understanding the sort of life-giving properties of the river, you know, and of water, in the way that water sort of allows crops to grow and animals to thrive and flourish and everything like that, as being somehow related to the potency of this god, is a pretty logical way, I think, of explaining the world around you.
It is. I like how they've linked. We know that this ingredient from a fella creates life. Let's apply it to the natural world.
Yeah, because we understand that water is essential to biological life, right? I mean, water is what makes us live, basically. And that clearly was what made the land of Sumer flourish as well. And so, yeah, it's just little things like that that show thought about the natural world and how it works. So there are sort of, maybe I would only say accidentally similar to our modern biological understandings, but nice coincidences nonetheless. So yeah, I think Flo, you alluded previously to creation myths. Creation myths are obviously concerned with water as well. Like we all know in Genesis, things begin with waters. And these same waters appear in Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian creation myth, and the sort of the fresh water of Abzu, which is actually similar to our idea of the abyss, though not etymologically related, unfortunately, are mixed with the salty water of Tiamat, who's this sort of sea monster divinity thing. And yeah, the mingling of the two waters is the basis of the rest of creation and creates this sort of primordial soup, which, you know, is what we now understand to be the place that life came from. But everything comes out of these two types of waters. And interestingly, they also crop up in another myth called Enki and Ninhasag, which is about the creation of the island of Dilmun, which is modern day Bahrain. And there's a nice coincidence there because there's a salty water and a fresh water, which kind of makes sense for the Gulf, where sort of sea and rivers meet. Bahrain in Arabic means the two seas. So it's nice that there's two seas, the salty and the fresh, in this myth and in the modern name of the island of Dilmun as well.
Totally off topic, but I love there's these little stick figures almost in from Dilmun that I see in quite a lot of pictures. I've got a necklace from Bahrain that's got a little stick figure on it. That's one of the Dilmun little people. I don't know. I think they're making beer or cutting crops or something.
Nice. I don't think it's entirely off topic then. You know, that beer is another thing that that Enki in his ejaculation allows to flourish in the Sumerian world order. So, you know.
God bless Enki's ejaculation for giving us beer.
I know. I shall think of that next time I glug down a Peroni. Yum, yum, yum.
Just on the semen front, did you know Athens also came from... Just while we're talking about semen, guys. The Athenians had a specific creation myth about Athens, that it came from one of the gods ejaculating onto the earth, but like the earth goddess, and then a mythical king of Athens and sort of the rest of the Athenians in the sort of mythical sense spring from that ejaculation onto the ground. So semen's important all over the place. Oh, wish I hadn't said that.
I wish you hadn't said that.
Apologies, everyone.
That's all right. Well, do you know, I suspect strongly that if you're going to be investigating anywhere in the ancient world, that's going to crop up frequently and will indeed be all over the place. So we've heard a little bit about how rivers are representative of life. Is that's, you know, civilizations spring up around rivers as well. So that's quite a sensible thing to think if you're in the ancient world. You know, this is where life is. This is where it begins. Do we have any sort of understanding of sort of genetics and evolution in the ancient world? Meg?
Yes, yes. I was hoping you would come to me next. This is so interesting, and I didn't know this before doing some research for this episode, but there is a sort of like proto-evolutionary theory in some Greek philosophy. So there's this guy called Anaximander, who's a Greek philosopher, you know, scientist. I feel like that's actually something that would be interesting to talk about in this episode, is when we call them all philosophers, but a lot of them are kind of, like Barney was getting at, doing a sort of an early form of what we might now call science, but just without the tools and the technology and the scientific method as we know it. Anyway, he was a philosopher, and he thought that the world came out of chaos, a sort of mush, like Barney was saying, primordial soup, a sort of indeterminate substance. The world comes out of that, and then it's water to start with, and then mud, and then land, and it goes from this kind of moist to dry progression. And he thought that people came from fish, sort of, that we were born in the wet and then sort of dried out and became humans later.
Oh, wow. So, like, really, really sort of close in terms of what our understanding is. That's really close.
I think that's what I like about the water being at the beginning of those creation myths, is that that's accidentally similar to how we understand life to have originated in the ocean now as well, before coming onto the land.
Yeah, exactly. And this is Anaximander. This is, I'm talking like sort of early 500s BC. Like, this is really early. This is pre a lot of, I don't want to say scientific revolution because that feels anachronistic, but in general in Greece, you do get, you get a sort of mythical understanding of the world, and then in like the like 5th, 6th centuries BC, you start getting more of what we might call scientific, kind of based on observation and stuff. But he's really, really kind of at the beginning of that and just gets it. And he had, there was a guy after that, Xenophanes, who was a sort of disciple of Anaximander, who looked at fossils and went, yeah, like we were, the land was underwater at some point. And he got that from the fossil record.
No way.
Apparently.
That's mad.
Mm. I don't think he understood. I don't think he like got it, but he was, he got like to the right place through the kind of, through a wrong route.
He wasn't figuring out Neanderthals then, but he was working out that we might have had a bit of evolution going on.
Yeah, exactly. Something that, something akin to evolution, yeah.
That's so cool.
Are these people, Meg, described as natural philosophers?
I think we could, yeah, I think we could definitely call them that. I actually, we can get onto this later, but I was reading something while looking at this stuff for this episode that said Aristotle really shouldn't be described as a philosopher in that sense, that he is much more of a scientist natural scientist. So I think a lot of these people, again, it's sort of, it is science, but just not in our way.
Yeah, I think that's why I was asking the question about, like, because natural philosophy seems to be used like in lieu of where we might say physics or biology or something like that, almost like it's impossible for them to partake in the scientific process that we now identify.
Yeah, and science, that's just the Latin word for knowledge, isn't it? Yeah, I was looking at like what words they use for this kind of thing. So the Greeks had like episteme, which is like knowledge, like where we get epistemology, theoria, which is like from a word for sight, so it was kind of consideration and contemplation, but that's where we get the word theory. Techne, which is like skill or craft. Yeah, loads of these different words. Biology is actually from Greek, but they didn't use the word biology. That's a modern term, but it's from bios, which is life, and logia, which is word or study. So it's the study of life in Greek.
On the topic of terminology, there's something that I've noticed about the natural world now that has its origins back in the ancient world, surely. I mean, we call things by Latin names. Zenny, was that because we were calling things by Latin names in Latin times, or is that something we've adopted recently or carried on from the ancient world?
Yeah, so the Romans definitely had Latin names for things, and some of those have come down, like mus, mouse. We, you know, the scientific name for a mouse is the same as what the Romans called it in Latin. But actually, the kind of continuation of using that sort of Latinate terminology for species and newly discovered species, that was invented in the 18th century by a Swedish guy called Carl Linnaeus, or his Latin name, Carolus Linnaeus. So the thing about education, actually, in for kind of most of history up until now, for the whole time that we've had a sort of a formal education, classics was the original degree. That's what people would start with. They'd start by learning Latin and Greek. They'd start by reading Latin and Greek texts. And then afterwards, they would sort of branch out into other specialisms like mathematics or physics, or the kind of modern experiment based science that we understand today. So for example, Oxford University, one of the oldest universities in the world, Oxford's first degree ever for quite a long time was classics. Oh, and then it was theology, and then it was maths. So that's kind of the order in which education happened for a lot of the history of formal education. And that's why even now, when we're naming new things, we default to the Latin system, because that's actually how all of the scientists throughout history were originally trained. They were familiar with these Latin and Greek terms for things. And so they'd like classify these new species that they discovered according to these Latin terms. So this system of naming that this guy Carl Linnaeus introduced, it's called binomial nomenclature, and binomial means two names, and it categorizes them according to the Latin names for the species and then the genus. So that's how you kind of put them both together in their Latin names. But now we've kind of done twists on that. So sometimes, even though the Latin formula is being followed, there'll be like a modern naming of it. So there are quite a lot of species named after David Attenborough, for example, and that just goes into Attenbergensis or Attenbergi.
So it's sort of, we're sort of faking it really a little bit there, fudging the information. Speaking of David Attenborough, do we have any people in the ancient world who were sort of Attenborough-esque figures? Because a lot of my education about the natural world, the animal world, has come from David Attenborough. He's probably the sole reason why I know that more animals than just hedgehogs and badgers exist. Did we have any David Attenborough-style figures in the ancient world?
So I would make the case for Pliny the Elder to be possibly the closest thing the Roman world had to David Attenborough. That said, there's still quite a big distance in between the wonderfulness that is David Attenborough and the questionableness of Pliny the Elder in some cases.
Haven't you been slandering Pliny for a few episodes now?
I do hate both of the Plinys.
That's one of the things that sets us apart from the rest of history, because they call him a friend of the podcast.
Really?
An enemy of the podcast.
This is the Pliny hate club.
But I think if TV had existed in the Roman world, Pliny the Elder would definitely have had many of his own series. And what he tried to do, he did say that like no one else had tried to do this before him, was he tried to pull together a whole natural history. It's 37 books long, and this actually makes it the longest extant work that we have from the Roman world. And he doesn't just deal with biology. He doesn't just deal with animals. In fact, he looks at astronomy, meteorology, geography, biology, zoology, and this is quite funny, he actually classifies animals in order of size. So he starts with elephants and ends with ants, which I think is a great way to do it. But then he also goes into anthropology, and he's obsessed with like unusual peoples and unusual places, botany, medicine, magic, gemstones, and art, which he categorizes as part of a natural history. So it's an incredible endeavor. But the trouble is, when he's doing something like that massive in terms of scope, then obviously he can't do all of his own research. So he's pulling together theories from lots of other people, particularly Aristotle. So what he kind of ends up doing is just perpetuating bad research instead of analyzing it critically or scientifically. He's kind of pulling together all of these different sources and mushing them into this grand work.
So he's just hogging all the science, basically.
If you count magic as science, yes.
Absolutely.
That was such a like tag yourself, that list.
Witchy vibes. I'm gemstones and magic. I wonder if he went a little bit loopy, because anyone who tries to hog documenting everything tends to go a bit loopy. And I'm not going to discuss it on this podcast. I'm going to let you Google it, listeners, because it's probably too NSFW to even discuss. But just have a look at the story of the man who tried to document all of the words in the first dictionary. Probably using cognito mode while he do it. Anyway, moving on, Meg. Any ancient David Attenboroughs from your side of history in the ancient Greeks?
Yeah, and Xenia has already given us a what's it called, like a next time on Against the Law, because it is Aristotle, obviously. David Aristotle, bruh. No, we can cut that.
I am not cutting that.
Leave it in.
I was like thinking about it, and then I panicked, and then I wish I had just not done it. But anyway, he was so interested in the natural world, as I was saying, kind of in some ways a lot more of a scientist than a philosopher. And like, you know, the famous painting of the Academy at Athens, and it's got Plato pointing up and Aristotle pointing down. Super famous. I want to say Raphael. Actually, got no idea. Don't know why I start talking about the painting. Anyway, Aristotle's pointing down at the ground and Plato's pointing up at the sky, because Plato's all about like the ideas, the forms. You know, he kind of gives up on trying to understand the natural world at some point. Aristotle never gave up on trying to understand the natural world, and wrote loads, well, several tomes, really long books, kind of like Pliny, about trying to categorize animals, trying to understand how sort of like genetics work. He was so interested in it all: animals, plants, minerals, people. And he saw, I think the thing that really links him to David Attenborough in my head is that he saw like a lot of joy in it. And there's a quote that I didn't look up the Greek, so I'm not sure if this is a good translation, but something like, in all natural things there is something wonderful. Like, he sort of loved the natural world, and he thought it was like a passion project for him to document it. And he came up with a sort of categorization system for all like natural things, including sort of living and non-living, which for him is a sort of important categorization, whether they're like plants or people, which I guess is also important for us. And he divides them all up into like, do they have blood? How many legs do they have? Do they have a soul? And are they hot, wet, cold, or dry? And that's his like system, and everything can be divided into those categories. So people have blood, they have two legs, they have a rational soul, and they're hot and wet. Whereas plants don't have blood, they don't have legs, they have a vegetative soul, and they are cold and dry. But they're also interested in categorizing minerals like stones and iron, which are non-living, and that's sort of about whether it has a soul. So he didn't think minerals had souls, which is interesting.
Speaking of souls, I have a Roman philosopher slash poet who had some ideas about souls. So we've got a guy called Lucretius, and he wrote this massive epic poem along the same lines as like Virgil and Homer, like that kind of epic poem. But he calls it De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things, or on the nature of the universe. Sometimes it's translated. And it is... it's science if it were a poem. It's kind of mad. Some people think it's mad genius. I think it's just mad and bad, but that's my personal opinion. And in two of these books, he sort of talks a little bit in what can be classified as biology. Most of it is more like it's atomic theory, it's physics. But in a couple of the books, he talks about his ideas on the soul, or rather the difference between the mind and the spirit, which he thinks make up the soul. And he says that the spirit is spread throughout the body, but the mind is in the chest. And that's where he thought the command center was, as opposed to the brain. He thought it was sort of the heart. And so because he's all into his atomic theory, he thinks that it's not possible for a soul to carry on after death. He thinks that if the body disintegrates, because the mind and the spirit are contained within the body, that the particles that make up the mind and the spirit, those also dissipate as the body decays, and they just sort of go back into the universe in their primordial forms. And he kind of got energy theory as well. Sorry, this is driving more into physics, but it helps to explain his ideas about the soul. So he thinks that there is a finite amount of energy and it only changes form, which I think is the first law of thermodynamics. Anyway, so that's how it kind of ties into his theory about the soul, is like it all dissipates, and therefore, this is his big conclusion, we must not fear death, because there is no afterlife. So death is not to be feared. And because he kept talking about the fact that there was no afterlife and we shouldn't fear death, Christians hated him.
I bet. Wouldn't that lead to quite a lot of hedonism, though? Because you'd be like, I can live life however I want, however the hell I want, because I ain't going to hell.
Yeah, so he's an Epicurean philosopher, which I think, Meg, we were talking about this before, weren't we? Most people think Epicurus is all about like eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die kind of philosophy, but actually it's more about moderation, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, not how we'd describe hedonism, but hedonist in a sort of technical sense. But yeah, quite different to the modern understanding.
So what you're saying is I can get those Dunkin' Donuts today and not fear, like, any...
not fear death.
Yeah.
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 Cholesterol level might be something to fear. But, okay, so that, I quite like that, that he's, you know, we're all energy and it's going to dissipate back into the universe and filter out in different ways, but you don't have a soul. I do find it interesting that he thinks that the mind is in the chest, because surely there will have been provable situations where it could be proven that it's in your mind, so injuries to the head. I know that in psychology, which is my degree, nothing to do with history, we can look at cases where someone has been kicked in the head by a horse, or in the case of Phineas Gage, who was tamping dynamite to blow up some space for railroad tracks, he got a tamping iron shot through his head and it changed his personality. Certainly that's the most ethical way that we can test for brain damage, is to take existing accidents rather than cause them and see what parts of the brain being damaged affects what. And it's really odd for me to hear that he has this belief that the mind is in the chest rather than the brain.
I think it's because, like, when you feel things, even though emotions are technically processed through the brain, often you sort of get that feeling in your chest, right?
Oh, true.
I don't really know why that is, actually. But I think that was their logic, is like, yeah, but we sort of feel things in our heart center, so that must be where we're processing the feelings.
Yeah, and blood was so important to them. And like, yeah, the Greeks thought that the heart was really, really important and the brain wasn't that important. I think they had some sense that something was going on with the brain, but they didn't think it was the sort of the seat of the body in that sense. They thought that the heart was really important. They thought blood was really important. Actually, I don't know if we want to get into the genetic stuff, but they thought the blood was really important, like for the sort of conception of children and for how you'd pass on. They didn't know it was genetic information, but they thought that blood was how children inherited sort of characteristics from their families.
I actually have, I didn't think we'd get onto this and I didn't mention it in my notes, but there's an Egyptian surgical papyrus that does mention head wounds.
Oh, what's their belief then?
Well, the surgical papyrus is a bit like some of the medical texts we talked about from Mesopotamia, where they're concerned with symptoms and diagnosis, and in this it describes a few skull fractures, I think, and there's a suggestion that there may be an understanding of the effects of head trauma. I think it doesn't say anything about the association of mind and brain in the way that we're thinking. And I think that's the position that is a little bit confusing, because we understand brain to be the sort of container for the mind. And yeah, as we said with the chest thing, that doesn't seem to be the case in the ancient world. But certainly the suggestion of that papyrus is acknowledging that somebody wounded in the head could, you know, display some sort of traumatic symptoms as a basis.
That is, they're smarty pants, aren't they? I mean, well, I say that, we really underestimate ancient peoples, or at least I do, with my understanding of the ancient world. Of course, that's being unpicked by you guys.
That is so interesting about the brain injury stuff. Also, if I can just hop back to genetics, there are a couple of really cool things, again, like kind of early understanding of this. So like I was saying about, they thought it was all happening in the blood. And I think we've spoken before about, they thought that like female menstrual blood was sort of a less good version of semen. So they understood that semen was involved in the, you know, creation of a baby, but they thought that like semen and menstrual blood were sort of half and half, and that was the important interaction. And they thought that like menstrual blood is like a less hot version of semen. Like semen's kind of got all this life force and it's really like hot, and apparently, and then the menstrual blood is kind of cold. It's so weird. It's so interesting. I'm kind of obsessed with it. And it's like, again, they sort of get like slightly near the truth, but not also way off. Aristotle did kind of understand that there was like a genetic development in terms of like an embryo and then a fetus. And he thought that something was happening in the womb. And this that kind of development process, but he thought it was all coming out of blood and semen rather than genetic information, which I mean, I guess is semen. So again, sort of half right. Also, do any of you know about pangenesis, that theory? Darwin was into it as well.
I think I listened to some of their music.
Hey, nice. No, it's all good. It's like the theory that all of an adult body gives off these sort of seeds of, again, what we might call genetic information, but that the Greeks wouldn't have done. So that like the whole body is sort of giving off like individual bits of stuff for the baby. So like if a parent has a bad liver, the liver will give off bad seeds. So the child will have a bad liver. And, you know, if you have weird hair, your hair will give off. And it's like, again, it's sort of right, because all that stuff would be in your DNA, right? Like if it's a genetic condition, like your hair, or if you have something, a genetic disease. But they thought it was almost this like physical process of the individual body parts giving off like that, those seeds. But yeah, Darwin was also into that, which I thought was interesting.
So I guess pangenesis is something that's been sort of disproved, because we have gene theory. What I do like is those kind of like accidental overlaps between what might be sort of modern theories, And then ancient conceptions of the world. As I was doing my research for this, I read a good point from an excellent Assyriologist called Stephanie Daly. And she made a point about how the words that they use in Sumer like reflect this conception of the world, because their nouns are divided into two categories, which is animate and inanimate, which I guess is a little bit sort of related to that kind of categorization you were talking about earlier, Meg, with Aristotle. Things that might have souls and not have souls, like rocks. And yeah, so like animate things might be people or gods, but also, you know, frequently animals and plants, and trees and stuff like that, not only considered animate, but also like might talk in literature and stuff. And I don't know, I just quite like thinking about this as maybe a little bit overlapping with modern Gaia theory, you know, that the sort of the world is this kind of unified system that sort of self-regulates, and all these bits sort of deal with each other, and just this thinking of the world as a more like animate kind of object, rather than just a sort of inanimate, dispassionate space.
That's lovely. And also, sorry, just to go full circle, Gaia is the Greek, that word is from the Greek sort of earth goddess, and she is the, when I said that when he ejaculates on the ground, on the earth, and that's where sort of this Athenian king comes from, that's on Gaia. So it's like the earth goddess is the sort of the soil and the earth that gets fertilized in that creation myth for Athens.
Lovely. Yeah, so I think, yeah, it's all part of that same phenomenon to kind of like explain the natural world. And I guess if, you know, if Gaia theory is concerned with the balance of these systems, then maybe this is a bit of a shoehorned link, but another good etiology that I was thinking about was explanation for the seasons, which I guess are one of those sort of big systems that governs, you know, the life and temperature and climate in the world. Because I think there's a very... Well, there's a classic myth, and I think it's quite a popular Greco-Roman myth about the explanation of the seasons that I maybe don't want to spoil, but unfortunately it has a precursor in the ancient Near East. Do you guys know the myth that I'm talking about?
Oh, do you mean the one where, so Persephone gets kidnapped by Hades, and then they kind of reach a negotiation whereby she's queen of the underworld for 6 months, and at that point her mother Demeter, who's like the goddess of fertility and crops, she's sad, and so it's autumn and winter and all the crops sort of wither and die, and then when Persephone comes back in the spring to be with her mother, then she's happy and all of the crops sort of start coming back to life again. Is that it?
Yeah, that's the one. And I think, yeah, I'd say popular. I think these were all characters in like a recent video game, for example, called Hades, which is about escaping the underworld, and then you get up to the beautiful garden up top. So yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the more familiar classical myths, and a great explanation for the seasons. But there is this precursor in the ancient Near East, of the story of the descent of Inanna, who is the same goddess as Ishtar, this goddess of sort of love and war, to the underworld. So she is determined to go down to the underworld. She's a bit of a rebel, and she basically breaks in to the underworld, just to see what it's like, and then returns. But upon leaving, she's told that she has to leave a substitute in her place, because you can't really escape the underworld untarnished. And she ends up throwing her lover, Dumuzi, under the bus, and he ends up going down to the underworld. And his sister isn't very happy with that. And so they negotiate a situation by which Dumuzi is allowed to come back up for half the year and then stay down in the underworld. So it's very, very similar to this Hades Persephone situation, but it's significantly older, thousands of years older, and has its origins in ancient Sumer. And Dumuzi's an interesting figure because he's a sort of shepherd god, and you know, represents sort of fertility and the animal world and stuff, and it's his periodic release from the underworld that causes the seasons. And a nice bonus etymology there, in many parts of the Middle East, Arabic speaking countries, Tammuz is the word for July, the month, which comes from Dumuzi. It was a month in the sort of Babylonian and Assyrian calendar as well. So that's the hangover. But yeah, nice little, it's quite rare to get etymologies all the way back, you know, that are in modern usage from the ancient Near East. But there's a good one.
That's really cool. So I feel like I've learned quite a bit today. And the way that I'm going to pick our favourite parts of today's episode is to go in order of creation. And of course, that's me to begin with. I'm the oldest of the crew and also the most stupid. So I'm going to start with my own favourite thing that I've learned today, because I never do that. And my favourite was Pliny, a.k.a. David Crappenborough, the sort of...
Yeah, that's better. That's a better one.
Yeah. The slightly dodgy, maybe not quite so accurate, but covers off a lot of what we consider as scientific information today. So that's my favourite. And I think the second oldest is you, Xenia. Xenia, what's your favourite thing that you've learned about today?
I really love, I think he was called Anaximander. Is that right, Meg?
Yeah, Anaximander.
and his pupil and their evolution theory. I thought that was so, so clever. And it's amazing, like, just how far you can get by just thinking about things. Like, I'm really glad that we have scientific research today and evidence-based stuff, but, like, thinking is a powerful tool.
It do be. It do be. Barney, I think you're next in line of creation. What's your favourite thing that you've learnt about today?
I really liked Xenia's explanation of the sort of origins of our modern biological classification, those binomials that we use. And that's just a brilliant way to see Latin still, you know, still around in the modern world. And yeah, it's just great to see, you know, these little connections with the past. And it gives me the opportunity to think about some of my favourite biological names, like Rattus Rattus.
Gorilla Gorilla.
Because I think Rattus Rattus just is really rubbish compared to some of the grander ones like Tyrannosaurus Rex, which I'm sure has some excellent etymology in it for both Meg and Xenia.
Terrible lizard, isn't it?
Tyrant
no,
King.
That's something
Tyrant
King.
Tyrant King.
I like that there was an echo in there.
That's the legion of people who are joining my cult of.
I would prefer the rat cult. If you're chanting the name of T-Rex, I'm just going to have rat, rat, rat.
Rat, rat, rat. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I'll have gorilla, gorilla, and you won't know if I'm just repeating gorilla or if I'm just using its Latin name.
Actually, I just thought, just before we move on, Tyrannosaurus Rex is weirdly like also a really brief summary of like ancient ruling systems. Because the Greeks, they called the rulers tyrants, and then there were kings. And then, so if you had like Tyrannosaurus Rex Emperor, that's it. That's like the whole system. Anyway, as we were.
And then you have the modern theory that the royal family are all lizards, so that's where the Saurus comes from, right?
Oh my God. We've cracked it.
Actually, Meg, I think there's a Tyrannosaurus Imperator.
Ooh. What?
No.
What, a dinosaur?
Yeah, like a super T-Rex. I remember I was obsessed with dinosaurs when I was little. Yeah.
Oh.
So there you go. There's the emperor.
Before we get too sidetracked, I'm going to move on to you, Meg. As the youngest, most recent creation, what was your favourite thing from today?
I actually do think it might be Barney's story that's like this precursor to the Persephone seasons myth. And I love that etymology. You know I love an etymology and I love that. What was it? Dumuzi to Damaz for July?
Tammuz.
Tammuz. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, I absolutely love that. That was great.
I too enjoyed that. I do, like Barney said, it's quite unusual to have something that we still use today that has its basis in ancient language from the ancient Near East. So that's really quite lovely. From that far back, anyway. So that's been biology. That's the first in our scientific trilogy. You can join us next time for more Scientific Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.